May it please the court.
Good morning.
Good morning. This is an appeal from a summary judgment in a personal injury case. Summary judgment was rendered in favor of the defendants. On June 25th, 2006, Angie Hansen was injured in a stairway in her apartment in Louisville, Texas. It was apartment 822 at the Villas of Vista Ridge in Denton County, Texas. About a year later, she filed suit in the 158th District Court of Denton County, Texas, and eventually named as defendants the owners of the property management company, the prior owner and prior property management company, which had transferred ownership and control just 20 days before her injury, and three companies involved in the construction of the property: Gray Star Development, which was the general contractor, Multi-Building Incorporated, which installed the stairs themselves, and Houston Stafford Electrical Company, the name of which has changed a couple of times, which installed the lighting over the stairs. Our brief details the contractual obligations of each of those builders and their responsibility for the conditions of the stairway. The principal issue argued in the briefs, both in the trial court and in this court, has been the issue of proximate causation. Many other issues have been raised, but the issue most vigorously argued and most extensively briefed has been that of proximate causation. I respectfully submit to the court that it was error for the trial court to grant summary judgment based on no evidence of proximate causation, because there was both circumstantial evidence of proximate causation and expert testimony, admissible expert testimony, going directly to the issue of causation. The circumstantial evidence, again, is detailed in our brief, but I will touch on the high points. On June 25th, 2006, Angie Hansen was seen by her husband, Joe, going down the stairs. It was a stairway leading from the apartment down to a garage. And Joe Hansen saw Angie Hansen go through the doorway to the top of the stairs. A few seconds later, he heard a loud noise, and he rushed to the doorway to look down and find her with her body laying on the stairs and her head on the bottom landing, her head below her body. That, I respectfully submit, is circumstantial evidence that she fell down the stairs. The stairway was enclosed. There's no dispute about that. So there's no extrinsic force pressing on her on this interior enclosed stairway. And I respectfully submit there is no competent evidence of any other reason for her to fall, or any other reason for her to be lying there upside down with her head on the bottom landing, than that she fell down the stairs.
Does the record reflect how long they had lived there?
Yes, Your Honor. They moved into that apartment, I believe, in March. It was approximately 3 months.
Okay.
About 2 months after the fall, Jim Seeley, a licensed architect with 40 years of experience, inspected the stairway. And he took measurements of the stairs and found that they were irregular in their dimensions, and that the irregularity exceeded that permitted by the applicable building code. These are factual determinations reflected in his report, which is attached to our brief at tab 2. He also found that the stairs were, in places, warped because the wood had not been treated in any manner. And based on his experience and his observations, he rendered the opinion that the stairs had never been treated, that they were untreated from the time they were installed. In addition, both Joe Hansen and Mr. Seeley testified that in the summer of 2006, when they looked at the stairway, there was only one light over the stairs, whereas the construction plans and design drawings required two lights to be installed over the stairs. The briefing is a little confusing on this issue, so I want to try to be as clear as I can. There was a third light specified for in the garage area itself, but over the stairs, there were two more lights specified, but only one installed, according to the evidence that we have submitted. And I don't need to remind this court that the rules on summary judgment are that all evidence must be construed in the light most favorable to the non-movement, and any conflicts in the evidence have to be resolved in favor of the non-movements. There is testimony in the record that only one light was over the stairs. Later, a professional electrical engineer named Dale Caffey measured the light in the stairway. This was about 2 years later. And at that point, there were two lights over the stairs, in addition to the third light in the garage. And Mr. Caffey found that even with all three lights on and the door to the garage open, the amount of light on the stairs was less than what is required by the building code. These were simple measurements made with a light meter by a professional electrical engineer. So in two respects, the record reflects that this stairway failed to comply with the applicable building code and provisions of the codes designed to prevent people from falling, the need for regular stairs and the need for adequate lighting. Now, Mr. Seeley, based on his observations and based on published materials which he describes in his report, rendered the opinion that Angie Hansen fell down the stairs, and she fell down the stairs because they weren't built in compliance with the building code. They were too irregular, and because the lighting was inadequate. So he did render an opinion on the ultimate issue of causation.
Mr. Fisher?
Yes, Your Honor.
How did the expert know upon which of the treads she was standing or walking when she fell?
He could not know for sure, Your Honor, on which one it was.
For
he did render the opinion that it was...
Yeah, were any of the landings... treading, were any of them built according to the plans?
My understanding, Your Honor, is that some of them were, and most of them weren't.
And in order for us to accede to the opinion of the expert that the irregularity in lighting were the cause of the fall, you have to assume that she slipped on one of those irregular.
I would say not necessarily, Your Honor. Because she could have begun to lose her balance on irregular stairs and then actually lit on a stair that was in compliance and then fallen from that point. It could be the cumulative effect of the irregularity.
And is that what the court's and the cases that are going against your position called speculating?
Well, I would submit in response to those cases that it's not speculation if it is the only plausible explanation for which there is any evidence.
Thank you, sir.
And that is, in a nutshell, my position to the court today, that she fell because of the defects is the only plausible explanation of which there is any evidence. The Supreme Court said something that's, I think, particularly weighty here in a case cited by the Cottonwood defendants on page 11 of their brief, the City of Gladewater versus Pike. The Supreme Court said that the question of foreseeability and proximate cause generally involves a practical inquiry based on common experience applied to human conduct. Common experience applied to human conduct. Here, there is evidence that appellees broke the law relating to construction of stairways. There is evidence that the particular stairway on which Angie Hansen was injured was not in compliance with the law. There is evidence that those laws were intended to protect people from falling. There's evidence that where those laws are not complied with, people tend to fall. That is in Jim Seeley's report.
But common experience applied to human conduct, sometimes people fall for all kinds of other reasons. I think that's the real issue. It's not a situation where, people only fall if there's some kind of defect in the stairway or inadequate lighting. I mean, unfortunately, people fall for all kinds of reasons that might have nothing to do with that. So how do we get around that issue? That's the crux of the matter to me.
Your Honor, my response to that point is that our burden is simply by a preponderance of the evidence, and it is not our burden to rule out other possible causes. As the Supreme Court said in Renfro, a long quote in my brief, which I won't bore the court by reading again, but it appears on page 18 of our brief. And the point of that quote is, it doesn't preclude recovery that the plaintiff was unable to prove with certainty that her theory of the case was in fact what happened, to the exclusion of all other possibilities. And a related principle of law, which is an axiom beyond dispute, is that there can be more than one proximate cause of an event. Every jury charge properly issued in this state includes that instruction. There can be more than one proximate cause.
So as I understand what you're saying, the question today is not have you proved your case, but is there something to go to the jury?
Yes, Your Honor, more than a scintilla of evidence. It's particularly telling, I think, that two groups of appellees, Graystar and all of the Cottonwood defendants, filed only no evidence motions for summary judgment. They didn't adduce any evidence of their own. Only no evidence motions. So as to them, it's crystal clear that there is no evidence that they adduced and are relying on of some other cause. There is only evidence in the record of one cause, one plausible explanation, and that she fell because the stairs were irregular. And it is within the practical, common experience of reasonable jurors that although sometimes people do fall for any number of reasons, that's not the most probable thing to happen. The most probable thing is that people manage to make it downstairs without falling, unless there is something interfering with their ability to walk down the stairs. In this case, we have identified something that the law recognizes as dangerous. And that, I submit, is enough.
Well, no, I understood, and maybe I misunderstood, that it wasn't just that the steps were irregular. It was that they were also untreated, and with the low light, it was hard to tell. They all ran together, and it was really hard to tell what the rise was on
yes,
the
Honor.
Different steps because they were different.
Yes, Your Honor, that's true.
Okay.
And that last factor, I would concede, bears more on the liability of the owners and managers than it does of those who originally constructed the stairs. Because the owners and managers who had a duty to inspect and maintain the premises, as we pointed out in our brief, could readily see that the stairs were visually confusing, that it was difficult to see where one ended and the next one began as you look down at them, particularly in the poor lighting. Now, as it relates to proximate cause, a big issue here has to do with the admissibility of Jim Seeley's opinions on the ultimate issue of causation and whether they're admissible or not. And I want to address those very directly. In their arguments that this court should disregard those opinions, the appellees engage in a little sleight of hand. They note correctly that objections to the substance of an expert's opinion, its reliability, don't have to be ruled on in the trial court. They have a problem here. They made a lot of objections in the trial court, and none of them were ruled on. And the general rule is all the evidence comes in and must be considered and considered in our favor on appeal. But an exception to that rule, I acknowledge, is an objection that goes to the substance of an expert's testimony. They can assert that for the first time on appeal, and that appears to be settled law now. But here's where they go astray. In arguing that Jim Seeley's opinion on causation is unreliable, they violate the rules applicable to summary judgment proceedings, and they zealously present to the court deposition testimony that tends to make his opinion seem unreliable. That is improper. Like any other fact issue in a summary judgment proceeding, the reliability of the expert opinion has to be determined by drawing all reasonable inferences in favor of the non-movement, resolving all conflicts of in the evidence in favor of the non-movement, resolving all doubts in favor of the non-movements. And appellees violate those principles by pulling in deposition testimony that contradicts the reports. If there is a contradiction, in this context, the report prevails under the established rules governing summary judgment proceedings. This is not an appeal from an order striking an expert witness. They filed motions to strike the expert witness, but they failed to get rulings in the trial court. So it's not proper, I respectfully submit, to do a weighing of all of the evidence and making a determination whether Jim Seeley's opinion on causation is reliable. That determination should be made solely from the evidence favorable to the non-movement. And when one looks at his report, which is at tab 2 of our brief, it is reliable. He identifies, he doesn't just say, here are my qualifications, I'm a smart guy, and here's the ultimate determination, there was causation. It's not an ipsy-dixit case like that, which numerous cases have said an expert cannot do. He describes in detail what he's relying on, treatises, studies, his observations described very specifically. He has a basis for his opinion, and his credentials are extensive and directly on point. So I disagree with the appellees that his opinion should be excluded because they're unreliable. But even if we assume that they should be, even if we assume that the court should disregard Mr. Seeley's opinion on causation, we still have the circumstantial evidence. We have Mr. Seeley's measurements of the stairs. That's not an unreliable opinion. That's a routine measurement and observation of fact. We still have Dale Caffey's measurements of the amount of light in the stairway. We still have Jim Seeley's observations that the stairs were untreated and warped. We have the testimony of both Seeley and Caffey on the building code provisions in their application here. Appellees don't argue that a professional architect and construction manager is incapable of measuring stairs, nor should they. And they don't argue that someone who has written and revised building codes is incapable of reading a building code and applying it, nor should they. And they don't argue that Mr. Seeley lacks experience in applying and even writing building codes, nor should they. All of those things are established in the record. With those things alone, and with Angie Hansen's body laying at the bottom of the stairs, with her body on the stairs and her head at the bottom, and no evidence of any other plausible explanation, that, I respectfully submit, is enough circumstantial evidence to meet our burden of proof of proximate cause. Now, let me quickly address an issue that is argued vigorously by all of the construction defendants, and that is that the plaintiffs, my clients, mispled their case, that they only pled a negligent activity theory and failed to plead premises liability. I respectfully submit that they are dead wrong about that. The court will not find the phrase negligent activity anywhere in the live pleading of the appellants, which is plaintiff's sixth amended original petition. What the court will find is that appellants pleaded again and again that the builder defendants were negligent. They were negligent in the construction of the apartment stairway. And they specifically plead all four elements of premises liability. And what they fail to recognize is that premises liability is a form of negligence. It is not inconsistent with premises liability for one to plead that the defendant was negligent. The plaintiffs here pled that the construction defendants were negligent, and that is in no way inconsistent with premises liability. All four elements of premises liability are specifically pleaded by the appellants. I'm going to go through the elements quickly and quote the brief of Graystar on page 15. The first element, Graystar and or Multibuilding and or Houston Stafford had actual or constructive knowledge of some condition on the premises. Appellants pleaded, and I quote, Graystar and or Multibuilding knew or should have known that the risers were not uniform and that the stairway did not comply with the building code and was unsafe for human use. End quote. That's paragraph 15 on pages 3 and 4. The appellants further pleaded, Houston Stafford was the electrical contractor for the villas at Vista Ridge and as such was responsible for the installation and wiring of the light fixtures. End quote. And continuing, Houston Stafford installed light fixtures in the vicinity of the stairway, which Houston Stafford knew or should have known were adequate to properly light the stairway and did not meet the requirements of the International Building Code, end
were
quote.
Were adequate or inadequate?
Pardon me?
Were adequate or inadequate?
Were inadequate, Your Honor. Okay. Sorry, I mumbled that. So, as to each of the three builder defendants, appellants specifically pleaded that they knew or should have known of an unsafe condition. The second element of premises liability listed by Graystar is, and I quote, that the condition posed an unreasonable risk of harm, end quote. Appellants pleaded, and I quote, the stairway in question fails to comply with the International Building Code. The stairway was negligently designed and or constructed and was unsafe because the risers in the stairway are not uniform, end quote. And they specifically go on to identify how they deviate from the building code. Paragraph 15 on pages 3 and 4. They continue, that, quote, the stairway was also negligently designed and or constructed and was unsafe because the lumber used was untreated lumber, contrary to the building plans, which tends to warp and to bend and to become irregular. The stairway was also negligently designed and or constructed because it was unpainted and unmarked at the treads, causing an optical illusion and causing a person using the stairway to step into the air, which makes the stairway unsafe. That's paragraph 16 on page 4. As to Houston Stafford, they make a similar allegation in paragraph 17 on page 4. The stairway was also negligently designed and or constructed and was unsafe because it was inadequately lit. But finally, as if there could still be any doubt that appellants pleaded the existence of a dangerous condition creating an unreasonable risk of harm, that doubt is erased in paragraph 20. Quote, plaintiffs further allege that the conditions described above, faulty construction and lighting, constitute unreasonably dangerous conditions, end quote. So how they can represent to this court that we didn't plead that element is beyond me. Turning to the third element, we find once again it was well pleaded by appellants. Graystar defines this element as follows. Graystar and or Multibuilding and or Houston Stafford did not exercise reasonable care to reduce or eliminate the risk, end quote. Appellants pleaded that again and again and again. In paragraph 13 on page 3, paragraph 15 on page 5, in paragraph 16 and 17. These are in the record, by the way, in volume 2, pages 525 through 527.
You're going to need to wrap it up. You got that red light.
I beg your pardon, Your Honor.
No, just wrap it up. It's fine.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor.
Quickly.
My final point would be that as to the owner defendants, and especially the Cottonwood Group, they filed only a no evidence motion with only 2 points. One was proximate cause, and the other one was that they didn't know of the defect. And there is summary judgment evidence, a contract in which they acknowledge in writing that they have inspected the apartments once and that they will inspect them again before a closing on June 5th, 2006. A mere 20 days before the accident. Thank you.
Any questions? All right, thank you. Greg, you next? All right.
May it please the court. My name is Greg Winslet, and I represent one of the appellees in this case, Multibuilding Inc. Your Honors, as a practical matter, we've got two sets of defendants involved in this lawsuit. One group is essentially known as the construction defendants, and another group is known as the premises defendants. I drew the short straw, and so I'm here speaking on behalf of the three construction defendants who, as their name suggests, were involved in various aspects of the original construction of the apartment complex. The premises defendants, arguments will be addressed by Byron Henry on behalf of those folks. Let me begin by telling the court that I certainly don't intend to take you through all the case law and all the arguments that are contained in the contractor's brief. Time doesn't permit that, and frankly, I wouldn't burden the court with that anyway. But very succinctly stated, on behalf of the contractor's defendants, I would point out to the court, really in the strongest terms possible, that the contractor defendants believe that there are two completely separate but equally compelling bases to affirm the trial court's granting of summary judgment. The first of which arises from the fact that despite counsel's able argument here a second ago, that the plaintiffs insisted at the trial court level on pleading and asserting a negligent activity cause of action as opposed to a premises defect case. And that, the Texas Supreme Court has made clear, is absolutely fatal when somebody puts all their eggs in that basket and proceeds on that theory of negligent activity as opposed to premises defect. Counsel indicated that that they pled negligence and negligence per se, and of course that's what the plaintiffs always plead in cases where this distinction is drawn. So a pleading of general negligence, which is what they did, and a pleading of negligence per se, which is what they did, as a matter of law, does not constitute a premises defect pleading. So that's number one reason. Number two is the lack of proximate causation. But let me talk a little more for just a minute about the negligent activity versus premises defect idea. As I suspect this court is aware, the Texas Supreme Court in 1992 decided the Keach versus Kroger case, and in that opinion, the Supreme Court set forth in very explicit, clear terms the distinction between a premises defect cause of action and a negligent activity cause of action. And it's widely established, particularly since Keach, that the fundamental primary distinction is that a negligent activity case requires evidence that the plaintiff's injuries were caused by some ongoing contemporaneous activity, whereas a premises defect case arises from an actual problem on the premises, a defect on the premises that eventually occurred as the result of some earlier activity by the defendants. The case law after Keach versus Kroger is very clear. There are case after case after case where plaintiffs have essentially put all their eggs in the general negligence slash negligent activity basket, and it's ultimately been fatal to their claim. As a practical matter, a premises defect case is harder to sustain, and from my reading of the cases in this area, it appears in some instances that plaintiffs actually make the conscious decision to go one direction sometimes as opposed to the other because of problems relating to proof, not the least of which constitutes actual or constructive knowledge of some particular problem on the property that predates the accident. And that's what the plaintiffs did here. I mean, obviously, this is outside the record, but this was certainly argued before the trial court in Denton. And plaintiff's counsel at that time reaffirmed to the court that this was not a premises defect case. He repeatedly indicated that this was a general negligence case. That's the way he argued it. That's the way he pled it. And this was despite the fact that the defendants had specially accepted to the plaintiff's pleadings from the beginning, telling him, you've pled the wrong thing. You haven't pled premises defect. It's despite the fact that the contractor defendants' motions for summary judgment specifically point out as a specific ground for summary judgment, you haven't pled the right case. The only viable claim you might have is a premises defect case. You haven't pled it, and you can't prove it. So basically what we went to the trial court on was a negligent activity theory, and the evidence is undisputed that the contractor defendants completed their construction work on this project 3 years before this accident ever happened. So obviously, as a matter of law, there's no ongoing contemporaneous activity that could have even arguably resulted in the plaintiff's injuries.
Mr. Winslet?
Yes, sir.
Your client is the one that constructed the stairs, right?
That's correct.
Subcontractor.
That's correct.
The stairs.
That's correct.
Did the plans call for the stairs to be regular in the construction?
Yes, and we won't run from that, Your Honor. There are some problems in the construction of the stairway, at least arguably. There was evidence in the record to support that there was some irregularity on one or more of the risers.
And was there in the plans requirement that the lumber from which the stairs were constructed be treated lumber?
Yes, that's correct.
And so, it's your position that those contractual provisions do not contribute to a duty on the part of your clients to make do the work in a good and reasonable manner and to make the stairway safe for use by the people that are going to use them when construction is finished?
No, not exactly. I certainly wouldn't go as far as to say that. I guess my position is that in the event where somebody is arguably constructs something in a defective or negligent way and it ultimately results in somebody's injuries, then yeah, sure, we can be responsible for that. But my point simply is that it's got to be a premises defect allegation as opposed to a negligent activity one. All right, now the other point I want to mention, and the one that was dealt with, I guess, most substantially by appellant's counsel, is the lack of proximate causation. A number of the court's questions in that area really dovetail directly into our position on that point. As far as the defendants are concerned, the plaintiff's position on causation is based on nothing but pure conjecture and speculation. And my discussion in that area, I want to begin by basically, I normally don't like to read from the record or read from a brief, but this is very short, sweet, it's succinct, and it is the linchpin of our proximate cause defense. And this is the testimony of the two plaintiffs, the two appellants themselves. Plaintiff Angie Hansen, the injured party. Is everything you know about the accident or your fall, was that told to you by your husband? Uh-huh. But you have no independent memory of that. Right. Now here's the husband's testimony, Mr. Hansen. Of course you agree with me that for good or ill, Mrs. Hansen doesn't remember at all how she fell. That's right. So the reality is she cannot tell us anything about how or why she fell back in June of 2006. Correct. You don't know how, if at all, your wife lost her balance and fell. Correct? Correct. She could have, just as likely, she could have tripped over her own shoes, as far as you know. As far as what I know, she could have been carrying a piano. I don't know. Question. She could have tripped over her own shoes or she could have tripped over her own feet. Answer. True. So the reality of it is, you don't have any information as to how she fell. Correct.
So what you're saying is, if a person is injured badly enough, or even killed, then y'all are home free?
Well, no, I'm not saying that, Your Honor, but I'm saying that there has to be some evidence from some source that basically fills in the blanks to give some explanation of how or why she fell.
I mean, this expert reports were.
Well, Your Honor, that's an excellent question. Let me address it in just one second, if I can.
Sure.
because what I want to basically explain to the court, and because this dovetails directly into a holding from this very court, Hopper versus J.C. Penney, which I will tell the court seems to represent perhaps the most cited case involving proximate causation relating to falls down a stair or falls down a stairway or slip and fall. It is repeatedly cited, and rightfully so. Hopper versus J.C. Penney out of this court deals with a situation just like what we're dealing with here. In the Hopper case, you had a situation where a lady and a companion were shopping at a J.C. Penney's. She was approaching a stairway. She tripped and fell all the way down the stairs. There was no denying in that case that she fell down the stairs. There were allegations that the stairway was defective, that there were problems with the building code, that the railing was outdated and obsolete, all of the same kinds of allegations that we see in our case. And the Fort Worth Court of Appeals in that case affirmed a directed verdict in favor of the defendant because neither the plaintiff nor her companion nor anyone else could give any specific testimony as to why she fell. The only evidence that they could come forward with was that she did fall. And there was certainly evidence in the record to suggest that there were some potential irregularities with the stairway and with this and with the railing. But what the court said was, in fact, again, I'm going to do it again. I don't like to do it, but I'm going to read a short blurb from this court's opinion in the J.C. Penney case, Hopper. Plaintiff admitted she did not know what caused her to fall. In other words, we're left to speculate whether her hand failed to reach the handrail towards which she was reaching or grasped the same only to have her hand slip, whether she missed the first step or stepped thereon only to have her foot slip, her ankle turn, her heel or toe catch in some obstruction, etc. Therefore, plaintiff failed to show any causal connection with the negligence or dereliction in duty on part of the defendant. The evidence proves only the fact of her accident, not the cause. In such a case, plaintiff cannot be said to have made out a prima facie case for proximate cause. Now, since Hopper, there have been case after case after case after case that have followed that holding. Hopper was a directed verdict case. You've got the Summers case, which is a summary judgment case, dealing with a fall off of a high diving board, where there were questions about the construction of the diving board and the railing, but there were no witnesses, and the plaintiff couldn't testify as to how she fell. So the court basically said, that this is just like Hopper. There's no evidence as to proximate cause. Shield is another case, a directed verdict case. Purcell is a summary judgment case, fall down the stairway. There was no evidence, there was no dispute the plaintiff fell down the stairs. There was just no evidence as to why. What's lacking in this case is any specific factual testimony like the court in Hopper said needs to occur in order to link up whatever the alleged problem with the stairway is and the actual fall. Now, Mr. Seeley, the plaintiff's expert, he certainly provided a conclusory opinion that these problems with the stairway must have been the proximate cause of plaintiff's injury. But the case law in Texas Supreme Court case, is clear as a bell that kind of a conclusory statement by an expert is evidence of nothing. It does not have to be objected to. It is because it doesn't constitute any competent evidence. Also, another note to understand about Mr. Seeley, the only fact that he relied on, he says, was an assumption that he got from Mr. Hansen that Mr. Hansen had been told by his wife that she fell while descending down the stairs. The reality, of course, is their sworn testimony is she has no recollection of it, and Mr. Hansen himself has no knowledge whatsoever in terms of how she fell. And the last case we cited in our brief on causation is the Burroughs case. That's a Texas Supreme Court case, just like this case. Where the evidence in that case, an expert came forward and said, proximate cause, I opine that this proximately caused injury, and I'm saying that based upon these facts. And then what the record pointed out is the facts that he relied on were directly controverted by the plaintiff's own testimony. And the court said his opinion is only as good as the facts upon which it was based, constituted evidence of nothing. The court reversed, insufficient evidence of matter of law.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Byron Henry, and I'll be addressing the issues that have been advanced by what has been referred to as the premises defendants in this case. While we certainly agree with counsel's argument, Mr. Winslet's argument, that the court could dispose of this case solely on proximate cause as to all the defendants with respect to the briefing on that issue and the argument, I'd like to deal specifically with the case from a premises standpoint, assuming, for instance, that this is a properly pleaded premises case, and assuming that the court finds that there's a proximate cause link to the alleged condition that could have caused Ms. Hansen's fall. There's a fundamental baseline issue with respect to some of these premises defendants that need to be addressed, and I'm going to address a couple of them now, but first let's take one that applies to all of them. The first issue is that these are all lessors, whether prior or current, and as a subset of premises liability, there's numerous cases, the best of which is Johnson County Sheriff's Posse cited in our brief, which say lessors owe no duty to lessees with respect to premises liability, except in very narrow exceptions, which I'll address in just a moment, because the assumption in the law is that they don't retain control over the premises if they lease. No evidence in this case whatsoever that that isn't what should be applied in this case. There is one sentence in the plaintiff's brief or appellant's brief that says that in paragraph 25 of the lease, because the premises defendants restricted the tenant's ability to repair the apartment and allowed a right of reentry, that constitutes a retention of control with respect to repairing defects. But that's been rejected over and over again by numerous courts, including courts addressing this specific lease. And Shell Oil versus Kahn out of the Texas Supreme Court, it's not in our brief, but it's at 138 Southwest 3rd, 288. And a case out of Dallas which lists all the authorities called Deitch versus Mid-American Apartment Communities, that's at 250 Southwest 3rd, 191, says that...
So you're saying plaintiffs had the duty to run more electrical, whatever necessary to provide lighting for these stairs, and that they had the duty to replace the warped wood, and that they had the duty to paint the edge of each of the steps, or to put a strip of that shiny stuff, that was their duty?
No, Your Honor. The exceptions that I had not gotten to yet are arrived at with respect to no control. Just generally no control, there's exceptions generally which apply specifically to lessors. The Supreme Court's opinion in Leftmark Management says that even if you don't have control, prior owners, lessors that don't retain control, there's two instances where you can still be held liable for premises liability, and those are if you agreed to make a specific known dangerous condition safe and you failed to do so, or you actually created the dangerous condition yourself as a defendant, which, of course, is not alleged at all against any of the premises defendants. That is an issue that Mr. Winslet was dealing with specifically regarding the construction of the apartments. So in this case, they never argued or even alleged at any time that any of the premises defendants agreed to make this condition safe or created it. So there is an exception for people in that situation. But the general case law is the assumption, unless there's something else in the record, is that the person taking the apartment takes it as is, except for the specific things that the premises defendant agrees to do or agrees to retain control of.
Well, and I'm pretty dense here, so I don't understand how you answered my question.
Well,
yes or no?
It's not whether
the tenants have the duty to replace the warped wood and to paint the stairs so you could tell where one step ended and one began, or to strip stuff, or did they have the obligation to add more lighting? Just ask the question, yes or no.
The law does not place the duty on the plaintiffs in this case. The law simply says that lessors owe no duty to lessees except for specific items or areas of the premises that they retain control over.
I'm pretty sure I didn't have the obligation to go do that. So you're saying nobody had the obligation to make it safe?
The case law clearly sets out who has the obligation, what the plaintiff's choices are with respect to suing those who don't have control. The assumption in the case law is that they inspect the premises before they take it, which is, by the way, in fact, what happened here. At 3 Supplemental Clerk's Record 617 and 626, there's an inspection and as is by the Hansons with respect to the apartment. and an agreement to take it as is, and an inspection with respect to the garage unit at 626 of the third volume of the supplemental clerk's record, that
and
they took it as is.
Only the people in that apartment could have access to that staircase. That wasn't a common area or a public area. It was limited to connect. It was part of that apartment.
Specifically leased to the Hansons, and that's also on page 626 of the third volume of the supplemental clerk's record, where they took it as is and agreed to inspect it. And specifically, the case law dealing with these lease situations is if there's a problem with the premises, the lease requires them to give written notice. And at the point they give written notice for a need of a repair or a fix, for instance, the case law then says, because you've put in your lease, you've agreed to do certain things upon request, now the duty shifts back onto you to take action.
Okay, and my question is, was the stairway part of the apartment of the plaintiffs? Was it common area? Who all could use this staircase?
It was specifically leased to the Hansons by virtue of the agreement. I do not believe anyone else had access to it, Your Honor. There's nothing, no evidence in the record that it was anything but a paid-for space. Actually, I think this garage may have been thrown in for no cost, but it was a rented space by the Hansons. And there's no evidence in the record that it was a common area to fit into the narrow exception to the lessor lessee duty. There's no evidence in the record we retained any control, that we agreed to fix it, or that any of the premises defendants created any of the conditions on that property under the case law.
Was it inside their apartment? Was it part of the parking garage? Where are these stairs?
It was attached. I believe the record reflects that you could walk out their kitchen door, and there was a landing, and the garage was attached there in their apartment complex, right there. They could walk down, they had a landing, go down to where their car was parked. That's what the record reflects.
Okay.
I do not believe the record reflects whether it was solely their garage, meaning someone else from an adjacent unit had access to it. It certainly was not a common area based on this record, and the record simply reflects that it was their garage, and she was accessing her garage through the kitchen door. The point from the case law is that there was no agreement, no retention of control of this area by the premises defendants, which is absolutely required in a landlord-tenant relationship. And there's just really so many cases. This court, its own case in Durham v. Zarkades from 2008, which is in our brief, details the exact same relationship, but then goes on to detail the exceptions to that. And that is the agreed to make a known dangerous condition safe, or also whether or not you actually created the condition, which aren't allegations against the premises defendants in this case. With respect to one other hurdle that they need to climb with respect to two of the premises defendants, and that is Larimar Management Company and Cottonwood itself, those are prior management company and prior owner. They're transferors. They were not in control of the premises. Even if you were to apply a landlord-tenant or disregard the landlord-tenant distinction and go with just traditional premises case where the owner, someone comes into a store and has an accident, they weren't in control of the premises on the date. It's undisputed that they were the prior owner and the prior management company. And there's, once again, no allegations that they created the condition or agreed to make this specific conditions alleged safe. And under Lefmark, it's pretty clear that unless you fit into one of those two categories, prior owners or management companies of premises are not, have no duty whatsoever to make anything safe. They don't have any duty at all, except for those exceptions we've discussed. Lefmark even goes
for latent defect that they misrepresented.
That's correct, Your Honor. There's two exceptions and two exceptions only. And in fact, in Lefmark, they were reversing a Houston Court of Appeals decision which attempted to apply Section 353 of the Restatement Second of Torts, which the Texas Supreme Court has never adopted. This court recognized that in its Durham opinion in 2008, went ahead and applied 353 just for the sake of argument and still found that 353 wasn't satisfied. But it's never been adopted, and there's numerous cases in our brief that discuss that. But even in that case, it is extremely narrow, and even Lefmark said it wouldn't apply to the prior management company. I mean, just a categorical bar, it doesn't matter. The management company is out under Lefmark, even if they actively misrepresented something. If they applied 353 at all, it would have only been to Cottonwood. And even under that, none of those exceptions and none of that was addressed by the plaintiff's brief except in one situation where they say that a complaint about the stairs being dirty in 2004 by a prior tenant gave everyone notice of the defective condition such that they should have corrected it. And so assuming that 353 applies and there's proximate cause, and you disregard the lessor lessee duty argument that this court has applied on numerous occasions, as well as the Texas Supreme Court, you have to find that the actual awareness that they're relying on, that these people that took after the fact, after these stairs were constructed, is a complaint by a prior tenant from 2 years before the accident that the stairs were dirty, despite the fact that Mr. Hansen's testimony was at the time of the incident, the stairs were actually clean. So the alleged notice of the dirty stairs, to the extent that's any type of defect, didn't even play a part in the accident under the plaintiff's own testimony.
And the fact that they weren't up to code, that there was inadequate lighting, that's just, we should ignore that.
You shouldn't ignore it, Your Honor, but I would point this court to a case out of Dallas, a 1994 case called McDaniel versus Continental Apartments at 887 Southwest 2nd 167, which goes through the discussion of how negligence per se and the violation of building codes play into premises liability. And basically, you cannot substitute a violation of a building code for the elements necessary. The only thing that a violation of a building code can do is satisfy one of the elements, that the defendant failed to take reasonable care to correct the problem. It does not mean that every violation of a code is unreasonably dangerous. The court in that case and subsequent cases still had to address whether or not a defect in a building code necessarily is an unreasonably dangerous condition. They also still said it never gets rid of the proximate cause analysis. And in fact, there's numerous cases which say, yes, there might have been building code violations, but show me how that building code violation had anything played a part or was the but-for cause of the accident. So I would simply point out that the fact that they're out of code does not just check off four or five elements on premises liability and move you right down to damages. You still have to make all the requisite element showings on that.
We need to wrap it up.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe based on the proximate cause argument and as well as the fact that the premises defendants as lessors had no duty to the plaintiffs in this case and the exceptions don't apply, that this court should affirm the trial court summary judgment. Thank you.
The argument just presented by Mr. Henry that there is no evidence that the parties he spoke for owed a duty to the appellants was not presented in their motion for summary judgment or in their brief to this court. There were two and only two points in their motion for summary judgment. I'm speaking of the Cottonwood defendants, and I'm going to quote them. First, there is, quote, no evidence that the Cottonwood defendants knew or should have known of the alleged dangerous condition, end quote. Second, there is, quote, no evidence that the alleged dangerous condition caused plaintiff's injuries, end quote. The assertion that no duty was owed was not part of their no evidence motion for summary judgment, which was the only motion they filed. And because there are numerous exceptions to this so-called no duty rule, it's very unfair for us to have to respond to that when we didn't even have an opportunity to put in evidence of the exceptions.
Mr. Fisher, how do you broach the fact that the Cottonwood defendants didn't own premises at the time of the alleged fall?
The Cottonwood defendants include, is a group that includes the current owner, which is WLA Vista Ridge 5 LP, and the former owner, Cottonwood Real Estate LP. So I want to clarify, that term includes both the former and prior owner.
Well, but I didn't see anything in affidavits or summary judgment evidence that connected those defendants in some way so that we could know what their interrelation was.
I believe, Your Honor, the contract of sale is in the record, and the public record of ownership from the county deed records is in there.
But what I'm saying is, just because you've got a sale from one entity that's similarly named to another entity that's similarly named, how do you know that both of those entities are some way connected in terms of ownership or other responsibilities that would cause legal responsibilities to arise as of the date of the incident?
I think I'm being dense, Your Honor. I'm not following your question.
What the connection is between two separate business entities that causes the flowing of a legal responsibility from one to the other, or are to be shared by both. In other words, they have common ownership, they have same people that are on the board of directors, same people that are running the operations as officers. What's their connectivity causes them to bear responsibility for a previous owner's, I mean, for a subsequent owner's legal responsibilities?
The direct answer to your question is a common law principle that a former owner or former manager, and I'll cite a case in a moment, has a duty, a continuing duty, under common law to disclose or to correct an unreasonably dangerous condition until the new owner has a, quote, reasonable opportunity to discover the dangerous condition. And I've cited the Luna case, this is on page 36 of my brief, and the restatement second of torts, sections 352 and 353.
Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. The second point made by Mr. Henry was also invalid. He says there was no allegation that they agreed to fix the problem. But the fact is that the complaint that was made 2 years earlier was not merely a complaint that the stairs were dirty. It was a complaint that the stairs were untreated and that they were wet. And it does not take an expert to know that untreated wood warps when it is wet. So 2 years earlier, they knew that this dangerous condition was festering. And it was reported on an inspection report, the specific purpose of which was to notify them of what they needed to fix. When the tenant at that time was moving in, and his name is in our brief, the day he moved in, he filled out an inspection report to apprise them of what they needed to fix. So Mr. Henry's characterization of that is inaccurate in those two respects. Turning back to proximate cause in my few remaining moments, I want to address the Hopper case because that's their favorite case. In Hopper, there was no evidence whatsoever that the stairs were out of compliance with any law. The court said...
Excuse me. You don't need any commentary back there. Go ahead.
The court said the stairs were, quote, obsolete. It was an older design.
I thought there was evidence that the rail didn't comply with the building code.
If there is, I'm mistaken, and I apologize to the court and opposing counsel. I don't believe there was any expert testimony that they were out of compliance with any code or law.
We need to wrap it up. Unless there are questions.
I'll stop. Thank you, Your Honor.
Are there any other questions?
No.
All right. Thank you very much. We appreciate your argument. Appreciate you coming here to answer our questions. It's very helpful. Your case is submitted, and you are excused to go about your business, and this court will be in recess.
Thank you.